We still don't quite have a quorum, but we're one away from it, so we'll officially open the meeting when that next person walks in. But because we want to hear all that wonderful information, you have to tell us, Ms. Boudreau, please start.
Ready to begin, Mr. Chairman?
I'm ready.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Linda Boudreau, Deputy Commissioner of Department of Human Services. I would like to mention, first of all, that Commissioner Goodnow would like to have been here, but he had a scheduled meeting with the tribes in northern Minnesota this morning, and so he sends his greetings and his regrets for not being able to be here. I would like to do a couple of things. First of all, give you a brief overview of the challenges within our department and within your committee, purview of your committee, but also like to give you a understanding of the department and all of the areas in which we oversee, and then I would like to have Chuck Johnson, the Assistant Commissioner, give you more information about the accounts under the purview of this committee.
Members, this is tab 16 that we're probably going to be looking at, so if you want to turn to that, it would be helpful.
Very good.
Please continue.
The Department of Human Services, our expenditures are projected to grow approximately 19%, or $1.4 billion from the 2004-2005 biennium to the 2006-2007 biennium, and that's based on the November forecast, which includes the General Fund and the Health Care Access Fund. Our general fund revenues are projected to grow 2.8% over the same time period. DHS spending already makes up approximately 25% of the state's general fund spending, or approximately 34% of our total state spending if all funds are considered. With the governor's budget proposal, our projected growth for Health and Human Services is approximately 15%. I think it's important that we understand that. It's also important that we understand that the growth that we're experiencing within our programs has required us to look at reducing some services in order to help balance the budget and to keep human services from consuming an even larger share of our budget pie, the pie share of our budget. However, whenever we have to make necessary reductions in human services, it is not an easy task, because our mission is simply that, to help people meet their basic needs. Virtually any reduction is something that's difficult to work on. But as we made reductions, our goal was to preserve the core services for the most vulnerable Minnesotans, children, the frail elderly, and people with disabilities. At this point, I would like to introduce, or at least first of all, have you refer to your organizational chart that hopefully you have. It gives you a better understanding of all of the areas under the purview of the Department of Human Services. And we have, I'm just going to mention all of the areas. I know they don't all relate to this committee, but sometimes there are overlaps, and so it's important for you to know what our responsibilities are. Under the Chemical and Mental Health Services, Wes Koistra is the Assistant Commissioner that oversees all of those areas that you see listed there. Under the area of health care, Brian Osberg is the Assistant Commissioner that oversees those areas. Under our Finance and Management Operation, Dennis Erickson is the Assistant Commissioner there. Continuing Care is Lauren Coleman, and he is the Assistant Commissioner that oversees many of the areas that you see listed. And finally, I kind of went backwards here, Chuck Johnson is the Assistant Commissioner that deals with Children and Family Services, and he is the primary person that would be referring to the accounts under the purview of this committee. And at this point, I would like to have him step forward and give you a brief understanding of the tasks that he has and the accounts and change pages related to the committee.
Welcome to our committee, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services with the Department of Human Services. As Deputy Commissioner Boudreau said, the area of the department that I lead is called Children and Family Services, CFS, and I may use that acronym at times as I'm talking through what we do. And that the area of the department that I work with is, I think, basically the same area of the Department of Human Services this committee has jurisdiction over. I think there's a few issues a little bit at the edge where there's some crossover, but it is fairly consistent that the part of the department this committee has jurisdiction over is the same part of the department that I lead. As the name of our administration implies, Children and Family Services, we work around helping children and families in Minnesota, and we work in partnership particularly with counties. Counties have a very big role in the parts of the department that that we oversee, and also with community organizations. We work particularly around ensuring the safety and permanency of children, of vulnerable children. We also work particularly with helping families and individuals trying to make a transition from dependency on assistance to self-sufficiency and into work. We also are working with developing options for long-term homeless, and I'll talk particularly about that in terms of one of the budget pages that we have. What we're planning on doing for the committee this morning, because my understanding was you wanted to get both a program overview and an opportunity to look at the change pages in the governor's budget related to the purview of this committee, is I'm going to ask, after doing a brief overview of the programs within Children and Family Services, I'm going to ask the directors of various areas within my jurisdiction to come up and give you a brief overview of the area that they lead, what the programs are, allow you to ask questions of them if you have questions, and then I will take up the change pages related to each of those areas as we're going through, so we can discuss both the program area and the change pages as we're moving through, and hopefully we will be able to move through this today. The Children and Family Services Administration has direct appropriations base for the 06-07 biennium of about $1.4 billion. Direct appropriations means general fund and TANF, doesn't include other federal funds, which would make it higher. That is obviously a large amount of money in the context of the Department of Human Services. We're the smallest administration within the department. Obviously, the health care, long-term care, continuing care areas are much larger areas in terms of spending in the department. We have several areas we oversee. Children's services, these are grants that in terms of general fund are about $86 million in the 06-07 base. This includes child protection. We oversee the work that's done to ensure that children who have been put in a situation where there wasn't safety can become safe, that they can get into a situation. We can work with the families to try to make it safe and, where necessary, work with out-of-home placement, moving kids into foster care, seeking permanency for kids, including adoption where that's appropriate. Particularly where parental rights have been terminated. We also work in the area of social services for children and families. This is an area where in 2003 the legislature made a pretty big change by taking what were 18 separate grant programs, combining them into a single grant that's called a Children and Community Services Grant. That grant for general fund is about $187 million in the base for 06-07. This is a large grant that's allocated out to counties that they use again for providing services. Targeted a lot of children and families, but also to vulnerable adults. We also have programs that are designed to provide assistance to those who can't fully support themselves due to illness or disability. There are three major programs in this area. These are all programs that are entirely state-funded. The first is the General Assistance Program. This provides monthly cash assistance to low-income individuals, some of whom are in a temporary situation in terms of their health problems or disability. But in many cases, these are folks who are transitioning to SSI, Supplemental Security Income, which is a disability assistance funded by the federal government for low-income families. And we actually do work with those folks in trying to make that transition to SSI. The general fund base for general assistance is about $60 million for the 06-07 biennium. We also operate the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program. This is a program that is designed to provide a cash supplement to people who are on SSI, elderly, disabled, and blind folks. The base for this program is $61 million for the 06-07 biennium in general fund dollars. And finally, we operate the program called Group Residential Housing, or GRH. This is a larger program, about $175 million in the base for the 06-07 biennium. This program provides, again, for people who have illness or disability, and that disability prevents them from being able to live independently. This program helps supplement the living expenses, room and board for those families, and pays for some services for those individuals, and helps pay for services for those individuals who are living usually in group residential kind of housing in the community. Finally, the largest area from a budget standpoint that's under the purview of the Children and Family Services Administration is the area that we call transition to economic stability. This includes child support enforcement, which is services that we provide to individuals to ensure that child support is paid as ordered by the courts. This is an area where there isn't a lot of general fund money, about $6.5 million in 06-07. There's a large amount of money that passes through the child support enforcement area as those dollars are moved from the non-custodial parents to the custodial parents on behalf of the children. This is also an area that while we don't have any budget initiatives this year, there are usually policy issues, and those policy issues would now come to this committee. The welfare reform area is another large area within the Children and Family Services Administration. The Minnesota Family Investment Program, as well as the Diversionary Work Program, which was created by the 2003 legislature. The grants for those programs, that is the dollars that are paid out to the families who are making the transition, is about $65 million in the general fund base and $238 million in the TANF base for the 06-07 biennium. This is time-limited cash assistance intended to be paid to the families as they're making a transition to self-sufficiency. Within that, there's also the MFIP Consolidated Fund. This was an initiative that was created again by the 2003 legislature. This again, like we did with the Children and Community Services Grant, took a number, I believe it was 11 different grants that have been out there, combined them into a single grant, which has been allocated out to counties and tribes to support their efforts in providing services to MFIP families and families on the Diversionary Work Program. The general fund base for that program is $17 million for the 06-07 biennium. The TANF base is $205 million. And finally, child care assistance within the transition to economic stability area. Child care assistance provides child care assistance both to MFIP families, families transitioning off of MFIP, and through the basic sliding fee program to other low-income families. For the MFIP part of the program, the general fund base is about $180 million for the 06-07 biennium, and for the basic sliding fee, the general fund base is about $61 million for the 06-07 biennium. Those are the major areas that we oversee. As I said, I'm going to ask Director Scump to give you then a more in-depth overview of them, and I'll then address the change pages. Just to introduce, before we move into that a little bit, some of what Deputy Commissioner Boudreau said about the strategy we took on the budget and how we looked at it. We were trying as much as we could to preserve core services to the most vulnerable people that we serve, and that was the priority we put in making all of our budget decisions. We were also looking where we could, and we will talk about some of these today, because there are several in our area, to make investments to protect vulnerable children and prevent long-term homelessness. There are some areas where, even in the budget situation that we were facing, we felt we weren't doing as well as we needed to, that there were populations where we needed to be making an additional investment to try to live up to our obligation to some of the most vulnerable people that we serve. And then finally, we did have to reduce costs. We did that by trying to control the growth in some of the programs and by delaying some new spending that was scheduled to come online. I'd like now, if there aren't any questions, just on a general overview.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, sir. Just two questions. What was your criteria for identifying a vulnerable person who the agency had a commitment to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark. The areas that I think we tried to target most were vulnerable elderly people, people with disabilities, and children.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
All children, no matter what kind of family they're in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, low-income children in particular being the population that we're most concerned with, and within children, those children where the safety and the vulnerability of the children is most acute as throughout our children's welfare services.
Thank you. One other question, Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
This is helpful to know for future reference as we talk about these issues, what you mean by vulnerable. In your overview, you talked about following people until the point of self-sufficiency, I think is the word that you use. That's the word you use. And based on the discussions that we had very early here, and information about what it takes for a family to become self-supporting, the kind of income they need to be bringing in from a job or a combination of services and a job, how do you think we're doing? When people leave after 5 years on this program, are they able to be meeting that criteria of self-supporting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, First, most families leave much more quickly than 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very small number of families that stay on the MPIP program for the full 5-year period.
That's true.
1 or 2% usually.
I was just going to say, if you could tell us, that would be it.
Most families leave, if you're looking at one episode, about half families leave within 6 months, but some families do have multiple times that they're on assistance over a period of time. I think that the degree of success varies or depends somewhat on how you look at it. We've done a longitudinal study where we followed families who came on to assistance and then followed them after they've left assistance, done surveys to try to identify their well-being after they've left assistance, particularly in terms of income. And I don't have those numbers on the tip of my tongue, but my recollection is that about after families have left assistance, I want to say about a quarter were still in poverty and 75% were not. And there were about 20% in that group who were above 200% of poverty, which is a level that is sometimes used to talk about a family that is, in a sense, fully not needing additional supports at that point and able to support themselves. Most families, after they leave assistance, still do access our health care programs for support. Some continue to use child care assistance after they leave MFIP. So those supports often continue to play an important part for families after they leave assistance, as well as child support. Families that have child support, where the child support is being paid regularly, much more likely to be successfully transition off of assistance and stay off of assistance.
Mr. Chair, if I could just recap that last thing of Nana. What you're telling us is only 20% of the people that we're working with on this program are able to be self-supporting at the 200%, which is kind of real basic. Let's see, what is 200%? What do you earn? Income, let's see if I got that. Sure.
$8.95
an hour.
Mr. Chair, Senator Clark, I'm not sure if that... I can't talk to that in my head right off the bat. I would say
that it's... Thank you.
I believe for a family of three would be around $30,000 a year.
Yeah. Mr. I guess I just think it's important for us to keep in mind what we really know about how we're doing and to keep checking back. Because one of the things that's different about these issues being in this committee is being from... previously being in the Health and Human Services Committee, I think one of the wisdoms of Representative Brad and another who wanted us to put these two committees together is that we really need to look at other tools we have that have to do with job training and so on that really aren't right now part of the MFIP opportunity. So just keep it in perspective. I didn't know that number. It's only 20%.
And Mr. Chair, I can check that to make sure I'll get back to the committee. That's okay. That sort of sticks in my head. I think also it's important to understand that in looking at most families are in transition, and most of the families that leave assistance are better off than they were when they were on assistance. And that's sort of the first step we're trying to take, is to get that family out there and working, to get their income up, to hopefully try to keep the supports in place that they need as they're making that transition. The cash assistance grant in MFIP now is at about 40% of the poverty level. That's not a level that any family can live at in a way that's going to help them successfully take care of and raise their kids. And so the first effort is really to do everything we can to try to get them into work, because that just automatically brings that family more income.
Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner. I have a question for you that I'm going to ask the commissioners as they come forward, which we learned yesterday there was a 20-60-20 formula used for prioritizing programs in the different departments. And my question is, did you use that, and will you share that with us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawik, I know that was a process that went on between the department and the Department of Finance. I'm not actually sure of exactly how that process was applied in the area that I worked in. I was not the assistant commissioner at the time, I'm not sure if there's anybody here who can answer that. I hope Jane is here. I defer to Jane Hardwick, the budget director for the department.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record.
Jane Hardwick, Budget Director for the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, Representative, we did conduct a 20-60-20 analysis. Essentially, we were asked by the Department of Finance and the Governor's Office to look at all of the expenditures in our programs and determine what we viewed as the core, highest priority 20% The next 60% highest priority, and then the relatively lower but still important lower 20% priority. We do have those documents available. They are not, I'm not sure that they would be terribly useful for you in this process. We did use those documents to inform a little bit what areas we looked at for reductions in terms of, as some of the questions were earlier, what were our most vulnerable populations. And as Assistant Commissioner Johnson indicated, that the information or the relative vulnerability of those populations was essentially what we used in that process.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up in terms of I would like to see those, and also how do mandates play into this? Because it seems like, you know, out of all the things we have, human services are, for the most part, mandated a lot of them. Did that some kind of weighting, because you really can't cut back on mandates, or do you just pass them on and shift them to the counties? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, we did not incorporate mandates and, for example, federal mandates into that process, because it created an additional layer that would have made it too complex in the constraints of that particular exercise. So that was not part of that process.
Mr. Chair, just state mandates? Were they left out too? Any state mandated programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Westenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm looking for some clarification here in understanding the chart here that Deputy Commissioner Linda Boudreau provided. Assistant Commissioner Johnson, you're basically in charge of this box here over on the left. And is it just this box on the left that is part of our committee's review, purview?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westford, that's my understanding, yes, that it's basically the programs and the budgets that are under the Children and Family Services Administration.
Okay, and then in this particular budget book that we have here, then, with the human services budget for the department, is this the entire department, or is this only dealing with the category here that we have here? I guess looking through the budget here, I'm trying to find if there's any description of these programs separately, and if anyone knows the answer to that.
Mr. Soderbergh?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's the entire budget that's put in. They were for good stuff. Not involved in that decision. So.
Okay.
Come on.
Work.
The entire budget is put in, I think, as an information item. But as you get to page, if you go to the white,
right,
you go through, then we'll be just looking at page 69. If you start on page 69, you'll start looking at the program level for as you go through the white. I think the color pages are more background information.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
Representative Clark?
Chair, I made a mistake. I want to correct it on the record.
No, you didn't do that.
Yes,
did
I
you?
Did. I was looking at my chart here for household income federal poverty guidelines, and I was giving the number for a family of one, which is not going to be the persons on the program. I'm sorry. For a family of three, which I think you were referencing, they would need to be earning $15.07.
That's a lot more than $8.
It's a lot more than $8.95, so I apologize. But I'd be glad to share this chart with anybody. I think it's really a good reference for us to know what it actually takes to be able to survive right now in Minnesota.
Maybe you can get some copies and pass them out to us later.
Thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, as we discussed this business about whether people are out of poverty, sometimes it's pretty confusing. And in the welfare reform, the House Senate bipartisan work that we did, one of the pieces of work that we did was to identify the other sources of assistance. Oftentimes, I think you even mentioned the NPIP cash, but as you well know, the NPIP cash is small, really, in part of the entire picture of public assistance. So even when a person moves off NFIP, it's likely that they're still receiving earned income tax credits, and the state's matched to that. They're probably on health care because we've separated those. They're probably likely getting child care assistance. Matter of fact, with the transitions, it's almost sure that they would be. They may be receiving energy assistance. They may or may not be receiving housing assistance. They may or may not be receiving free and reduced lunch. They may be receiving food. And I'm just, this is just a partial list. I think we had, I don't know, something like 15 or 20 items. And when we talked about what those were, it is fairly significant if you dollarize those and then put that against the person's earnings. When you say something about, let's say, for example, someone leaves MFIP, and where are they in relationship to Representative Clark's index as far as their income, whether or not they're still in poverty, do we include those things as other kinds of assistance that they may be receiving?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, that's an excellent point in terms of all those resources, and particularly in terms of the tax credits. In terms of the numbers I was referencing, we identify everything that we can either gather from our administrative records, which includes essentially things that are delivered through the Department of Human Services, and things that we thought we could reliably gather from a survey interview with the parent. One thing that is not included there is tax credits, which are actually the biggest piece of, from a pure income standpoint, in terms of supporting low-income working families. So those numbers do not include the tax credits, which we didn't think we'd get reliably from the parents, nor do we have access to, obviously, for data privacy reasons, from the federal government. That in particular, I think, is the item that is most important probably to supporting low-income families that was not included in our analysis. We did capture most everything else, I think.
Mr. Chair, just a comment to that. I mean, it is a very complicated. I think we spent considerable time in that, but it is important to keep in mind as we sort of examine how well people are off and whether they're in poverty or not and what they are. We have a complex network, and I only gave you just a few examples, and there's many more, too, that are part of the overall safety net. The MFIP cash payment sometimes is sort of seen as the, but it's in many respects, it's a small piece, really, of what may be part of that family's sort of disposable income. If you have somebody, the taxpayers helping your health care, for example, as opposed to a family across the street that may be just above the line, that may be several hundred dollars a month of value to that family. Just something for us to keep in mind.
Thank you.
Representative Clark. This just reminds me that we do need to finish having the testimony from several groups that didn't get to testify on our early
discussion. That's a good point, and I think several others have been added, in my mind at least, and as soon as we can find our way clear after the budget overviews and things, we'll consider that.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, would you continue, please?
Mr. Chair, thank you. What I'd like to do now is start talking about some of the program areas within the department or in the Children and Family Services Administration, and then then I will discuss the budget pages that are related to those areas. I'd like to start with the Child Safety and Protection with Aaron Sullivan Sutton, who's the Director of the Child and Safety and Permanency Division. I'm going to ask the directors. I thought it would be helpful to bring some of these folks up, because the committee is new to our department, to get to so understand who the key folks are who work with each of the areas, and to have them give a very brief overview of what they do in their area, and before we talk about the budget pages.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Aaron Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Director of the Division of Child Safety and Permanency at the department. In my area of the department, we work very closely with counties and tribes to ensure the safety, permanency, and well-being of vulnerable children. We particularly focus on working with children and families where their children have been abused or neglected or are at risk of abuse and neglect, children who are in out-of-home care, and children who are in need of adoption. As you know, in Minnesota, we are a county-administered, state-supervised system, and so the work of the department primarily is focused on helping provide the supports and infrastructure for counties to do the day-to-day work they're responsible for. To give you a picture of the scope of these issues in Minnesota, I want to give you some figures very quickly. In 2003, counties responded to almost 18,000 reports of child abuse and neglect involving almost 25,000 children. And a lot of our work over the past couple of years has been working very closely with counties, tribes, and community providers to reform our child protection system in Minnesota, as was authorized by the 1999 legislature. In doing that, we implemented what we call alternative response to allow for a continuum of responses and supports to families who are identified as being at risk of abuse and neglect. Historically, the child protection system has been very punitively focused and was focused on conducting investigations to determine if parents had maltreated their children. And as you may guess, that approach does not work for many families. And so we implemented a more family-oriented support system and a response for families who are reported to the child protection system. We reformed the system so that at least in cases that were allegations were not of high-risk situations, that the focus was working with families to engage families in looking at safety of their children. We began in the year 2000 and conducted a four-year pilot program starting in 20 counties. We did have an independent evaluation of the reform system, and I'm pleased to report that the results are very positive, and I'm going to give you just very quickly what we learned in that process. The reform initiative involved 5,000 families. We had an experimental group and a control group, and so we were able to look at the differences that and outcomes for those families. In the evaluation, we received feedback from almost 1,200 families. The major findings that I want to go over very quickly indicated that child safety was not compromised in this approach. In fact, families in the AR experimental group, children experienced greater degrees of safety, and we think that that's attributable primarily to the opportunity for services with those families. Families receiving the alternative response approach were less likely to have new reports of maltreatment than the control group, and those families where there was a new report of maltreatment, they came back to the system less serious than the counterparts would come back. We learned that the initial cost of providing alternative response and services were a little bit higher than the traditional investigative approach. However, in the long run, this approach was less costly and more effective for both families and children. Most families liked the alternative response approach and felt that they were responded to in a more supportive and friendly manner. They were also able to be more involved in the decisions around their lives and their family and more involved in case planning. Social workers across the state also liked this approach with working with families. They felt that they were really being able to provide social work services and supporting families in a much more positive manner than the traditional child protection system. Interestingly enough, we also learned that the mean income of families who were receiving the alternative response increased after the case closed. And we think we know that that's attributable to the little bit of flexible funding that allowed families to meet some of their basic needs so that they were in a better position to maintain employment and get to their jobs. As of January 2004, on a voluntary basis, all of the counties implemented this new alternative response approach, and I think hope you will be hearing more about this in your committee in the coming months. We also have responsibility for working with counties and tribes for children who are in out-of-home care. In 2003, over 15,000 children in Minnesota spent some time in out-of-home placement.
What was that number again, please?
Over 15,000. The majority of those children were adolescents, and the majority were Caucasian children. More boys than girls experienced out-of-home placement in Minnesota. And although most of the children were white, it's important to note that there are significant disparities or disproportionality for African-American and American children in out-of-home placement. African-American children are in out-of-home care four times their rate of representation in the general population, and American Indian children are represented in care at seven times the rate of their representation in the general population. Most children in out-of-home care are in family foster care. 55% of the kids who enter out-of-home placement enter for reasons related to their parents' inability to provide care. The remainder enter care because of reasons of the child's own disability or the child's behavior or substance abuse on the part of the child. most children return home to their families within the first year. In fact, 80% of the children are able to be reunified with their families within 1 year. Unfortunately, not all children can return to their families. And when part of our work with the counties is to help them develop strategies and best practices to support reunification, as well as to look for alternative permanency plans for children who cannot be reunified safely with their families. In any given year in Minnesota, about 700 children, their parents have their parental rights terminated, and those children are in need of adoption. In 2003, 714 children who were wards of the state or under the Commissioner of Human Services guardianship were adopted in Minnesota. On any given day, there are about 1,500 children who are wards of the state. Part of our work with adoption is to, we have responsibility for recruitment and training of adoptive parents. We work very closely with community-based agencies as well as counties and tribes to support the adoption of children who are in need. At the department, we also maintain the state archive for adoption records, so we have a history of all adoptions occurring in Minnesota that goes back actually to the 1800s. One of our responsibilities is operating the Adoption Assistance Program. The Adoption Assistance Program is a cash assistance program to help families who are adopting special needs children. These children are children who have, for the most part, experienced traumatic events in their early development. Most have been abused or neglected, or both. These children are children with neurological or medical issues, and they require special psychological, medical, education, or social services. About 80% of the children who receive adoption assistance are also eligible for federal, what we call Title IV adoption assistance programs. About 4,000 children are on the adoption assistance program today, and these funds help families provide the resources that are needed to care for children in their homes. For children who are not adopted, another permanency option for them is that they can be live permanently with relatives in what we call a transfer of permanent custody to a relative. In those situations, the court has determined that a child cannot return safely to their biological or parent family, but that it's in that child's best interest to live permanently with relatives without a termination of parental rights. We also have what we call the Relative Custody Assistance Program that provides financial support on a means-tested basis to relatives who assume permanent legal responsibility for children. Again, these are children that are very similarly situated to children on the Adoption Assistance Program. There's about 1,900 children on that program today. Unfortunately, some children are not able to be adopted or live permanently with relatives, so we also have responsibility for working to support the transition of adolescents from out-of-home care into adulthood. In 2003, we had 1,200 kids who were 16 or over who were wards of the state that were not able to be adopted or whose permanency disposition was long-term foster care. More than half of those kids are kids with disabilities or impairments that affect their ability to achieve and sustain housing and economic stability. Children who are in foster care as adolescents exit foster care either on their 18th birthday or the day they graduate from high school generally. And we have a responsibility to work with counties and others to assure that there's intensive independent living, planning, and skills development for those adolescents that are going to transition to adulthood on their own for the most part. And we believe that in order for kids to successfully transition, we really need to help them with education, training, life skills development so that they can achieve economic self-sufficiency. One of the programs that we administer is a federal education voucher program that provides financial assistance to youth to help support their educational development through either college or post-secondary education. Just a couple of other brief highlights. In my area, we also work with counties in partnership and the University of Minnesota to operate what we call the statewide child welfare training system that provides intensive training for people working in the field, as well as training to foster and adoptive parents. One of our responsibilities is oversight of the local child welfare system, and we work very closely with counties to conduct what we call quality assurance reviews, where we look at county-by-county practices with the goals of improving safety, permanency, and well-being for children who are part of the system. It, part of our work, we work very closely with the Minnesota Supreme Court in partnership to also improve the court processes and reduce delays in the court system. These programs are not operated in isolation with social services, but are very closely tied to our judicial system in Minnesota. And finally, we operate the technology supports what is known as the Social Service Information System. That is a case management tool. We support 3,000 users across the state who work with child welfare and in this case management system, and it's part of our federal responsibility as well to be able to track and maintain information regarding these services.
Any questions from members on the overview we just had? Reserve Clerk.
Mr. I have a lot of questions because this is new to this committee again, but I know in my own county I was told, I think it's probably within the last 2 years.
Everything happens in your county.
We have a lot of good people. And we have people with some real issues. And in fact, some counties send people to our county as a way to take care of their particular issues. We give them a bus ticket. But anyway, in Hennepin County, I was told, I think within the, it's probably two and a half years, that children who were adolescents over the age of maybe 11, if they had a child protection issue, there just weren't enough child protection workers to give them the kind of help that they needed, and all the priorities went to younger kids, so that we had these, you know, young teenagers pretty vulnerable. And I'm just wondering what the new program, the alternative program, if that's had an impact, if you know in my county or other counties, can that still be said, that if you've got a kid who's being abused in a home, they're over 11 years old, 10, 11, 12, whatever, they might as well, relatives or neighbors might as well forget reporting it because nothing's going to happen because they're not the little kids. So has that changed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I don't know that that has changed. There was not a lot of new resources that were put into alternative response to expand the number of reports that could be responded to. We also hear concerns about situations where older children are reported to be abused or neglected, and have had a number of conversations with counties about their responsibilities to investigate reports, all reports of maltreatment. But I do know that it is a challenge, and some of the counties have prioritized, and I believe Hennepin County is in that situation.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, they prioritized younger children versus helping the teenagers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, that's my understanding.
Mr. Chair, I just think that's really a problem. I know there's a 13-year-old in our block who was regularly beat by his father, and numerous ones of us called him. We could get no help.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, those situations also should be reported to the police and law enforcement.
Actually, Mr. Chair, that did happen, and the child was eventually, you know, a year down the road, and removed from the home. But, you know, there's a lot of suffering there. And what was basically told was there's just not enough child care protection workers to help with that. So I was hoping the new program might have actually helped, but it sounds like we're still underfunded in what you're saying.
Certainly one of the biggest concerns county officials have when you talk to them is the increasing cost of out-of-home placements, not only in Hennepin County, but also in Martin County. So it's a growing concern. Representative Slavik.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Sussman-Stillman, if I get that right. I have a question for you about, I heard from Washington County very, very good things about alternative dispute resolution, so they're very pleased, and I think it's going well. One question I have is, where do these sort of, remember we used to hear about residential academies, and remember Carlson had that deal on that, these kids that sort of the teenagers that where they don't fit in, is there still a move towards that, or where do these kids physically wind up?
Ms. Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, were a couple of residential academies that were developed in probably the last 6 or 7 years in Minnesota. One was in Minneapolis that has since closed. There's also one in Faribault that's operated by Catholic Charities that has a very low enrollment. Most kids end up in family-type situations. Kids who are in need of, for example, more intensive mental health services may be placed in a residential facility for a limited period of time, but the goal is to get kids back into their communities and families and receive community-based care if at all possible. One of the focuses that we have and concerns is for kids who are in the system and out-of-home care, as I mentioned, in their transition to adulthood, is to be able to support them, because we know, and according to Wilder, there are about 600 to 700 kids, young adults who are homeless in Minnesota on any given day. About 70% of those kids had been in the child placement system at one point, and we believe that it's essential that we work harder and do more to support those children so that they do not end up homeless.
Mr. Chair, I just comment that Representative Clark's question, I think, highlighted one of the basic points that we need to understand within this part of our business, which is that the counties have a lot of responsibility fiscally for these services. And in the evolution of human services over time, the state has taken over the cost of a lot of things, but this is an area, as you mentioned, where counties still have the basic responsibility through county property tax dollars, and they do get some federal reimbursement, but for providing these services, for paying for out-of-home placement costs and so forth. So as we think about how we're managing this area, that's one reality we need to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. It has been said that it's one of the fastest growing budget items in the counties. There's a lot of success stories, too. I know some foster care families. I remember one in Brooklyn Center that did a wonderful job of taking care of these young people as they get older and transitioning them into adulthood. And they really developed an extended family mode. It was really something to watch. So hopefully we'll have more of them. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much for your presentation.
Mr. Chair, what I would like to do now is to turn to address the budget change pages in the department, the part of the department that deals with child welfare services under Ms. Sullivan Sutton's purview.
You know, give us a page number.
Yeah, please. I would start on page 13 of the change pages. They're the yellow pages in your book. Well, there's two different kinds of yellow, I think. Right after the SAM, I guess, color page. Mr. Chair, this is the page entitled American Indian Child Welfare Project. If folks are having trouble finding it, it's page 13 in the overall book. Mr. Chair, this is an item where the department is proposing an additional investment of $4.8 million starting in fiscal year 07 and going forward. This is a project to support two Indian tribes in providing the full range of child welfare services to children living on the Indian reservation. As Erin mentioned in her remarks, the American Indian children are one of the populations that we do not do well with in the child welfare system. The disparities are very large. We get about 1,000 reports of abuse and neglect a year on American Indian children, about 48% of which are determined to be abuse and neglect has occurred. We have about 1,300 kids in out-of-home placement to our American Indian at a point in time. And about American Indian kids are about 6 times more likely to be removed from their homes than other children. This is a long-standing area where we have not been successful in working with these children, where huge disparities exist. The best services, we believe, for these children are often inhibited by the basic structural arrangement of how child welfare services are delivered in tribal areas. Essentially, in tribal areas, the tribal court has jurisdiction over making decisions about what should happen with the case, whether or not abuse has occurred, whether the child should be removed, what kind of steps should be taken after that. But the counties actually are the ones who are responsible for paying for and carrying out the fiscal side of supporting those kinds of decisions. And in some cases, this does lead to tensions between the counties and the tribes. And it's not that I think people aren't trying to do the best that they can to work in these situations, but structurally it's a situation where it's very hard, where the lines of authority are just not very clear. And we believe that often results in conflicts over service plans and not necessarily the best plan or the best follow-through for serving these kids. And there's also an issue of the county's financial capacity. When we look at the northern reservations where the big numbers are, these are counties that don't have a huge financial capacity to be supporting the high costs of out-of-home placement and some of the pieces that come with this. Just looking at White Earth and Leech Lake reservations alone, for kids on those reservations, the out-of-home placement costs in a single year are about $4 million. We also think that this is an area where, as I mentioned before, historically the state hasn't had a large fiscal responsibility. We know that we have a responsibility for these kids, and we're doing a better job of trying to serve these kids. And we've concluded that one thing we'd like to try in terms of moving forward with this population, is to put some money out there that would allow the tribes to take up more of the service responsibility for providing services to these kids. This proposal would allow the commissioner to enter into agreements with two tribes wherein we would pick up a portion of the non-federal share of providing the range of child welfare services to kids who live on the reservations in those areas. This would relieve the counties of the fiscal burden of doing this, and it would also, we think, align better the authority with the tribes and help them provide more culturally competent kinds of services to those children. And ultimately, what we'd be looking for is better safety outcomes and better permanency outcomes for the children. As I mentioned, this is an initiative that we are proposing $4.8 million in investment starting in fiscal year 07.
Representative Clark.
I do have a question about this. I happen to have a very, some of the tribal leaders tell me we have the largest urban American Indian population in the state, right in South Minneapolis, and it's a very rich, culturally rich community with lots of institutions, old and developing, that really provide a lot of support to American Indian families. So I'm wondering why this is limited to the children when they're on the reservation. Many of the children that I know, families I know, travel back and forth, and sometimes an aunt or grandmother that is taking responsibility for the child under the Indian Child Welfare Act, trying to keep those families together, is in the city, or maybe back and forth. And it seems to me we might want to build in a little more flexibility here, because if it's only limited to when those children are on the reservation, I think you'd be cutting out a whole part of the family that, from what I can tell, is a really important option for placement. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, that is a good point. A lot of the interaction does take place with counties that are outside of the immediate tribal area and with kids who aren't members of a tribe but not living on the reservation. This is the structure that it was more sort of as a place to start, I think, to look at those issues that are there that seem to be most acute in the reservation area. There would need to be some work back and forth, because as you mentioned, sometimes the placements are actually occurring in other places, and so that would need to be considered as part of the overall project. But we thought we wanted to start with kids who were on the reservation land, just sort of as a starting point for it.
Mr. Chair, I might have an amendment for this bill.
pardon me? I think Representative Wolfkin, if you're done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Johnson, just looking at the description in the book here, it says in 2003, 1,000 children from one tribe. Do we have any idea what percentage that is of the children within that tribe?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, no, we don't, but we can go back and look at that and get an answer back to you.
Okay.
My understanding was actually that 1,000 was across all tribes, and so we're wondering whether that's actually is an accurate statement in the budget book.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Johnson, I think that would be important to know, because if that was one tribe, there might be some pretty serious cultural problem going on there that while doing this program might be important, doing something to change what the culture is that's causing that might be more important to prevent it in the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, I do know that the two tribes that we've been most interested in trying to work with on this proposal, and actually Commissioner Goodnow is visiting them over the next couple of days, are White Earth and Leech Lake. Those two tribes have the highest numbers in terms of just about every way you look at it. Kids reported, kids determined to have been abused, kids in out-of-home placement, and so forth. So in terms of the sheer numbers, those are the two largest.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Slough.
Mr. Chair, Assistant Commissioner, I feel compelled to ask this question just because I think the timing is interesting. And obviously the state is and the governor is working with three tribes on expanding casino proposals, and two of those happen to be in this proposal. And I think that this has been an issue for a long time, and the fact that it's proposed this year is rather interesting. How did this come about, and have the tribes, obviously you're working closely with them, and it's been coming about for a while, and you've just decided this is the year to do it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slavik, it has been evolving for a while, and I think that it is something that Commissioner Goodnow has made one of his priorities when he came in as commissioner. He has made countless visits to the tribe. Actually, they're probably countable, but he has made a lot of visits to tribes to try to figure out how we can work better with them. And he has a very particular concern on safety and permanency of children as being one of the things that the department needs to be focusing on as part of, I think, really trying to focus on the most vulnerable and at-risk populations that we serve. I think that it came out of just when you all the things that we've tried to do to make this issue work, it seems like this is the place that we always land, is that it comes back to that there is a disconnect in the lines of authority in how this is done. And it does create tensions with counties who don't have a huge financial base to be trying to support the level of poverty and the kinds of issues that are going on with the kids on the reservations. So I think it is just the next step in the evolution of trying to figure out how to work better with this population. In a number of other areas, we have been moving toward trying to work more directly with the tribes to give them funds to deliver services more directly. We've done that in the MFIP area, where there is a tribe that delivers its own TANF program, and there are four other tribes that deliver employment services to the American Indian members who are in the MFIP program. So that, I think, general trend of how we're trying to work with tribes to help them build more capacity to deliver services is going on across the department.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. I have been to Leech Lake, and there is an enormous amount of poverty, and the county issues are very real. So I'm glad to see this. That at some point, I'd like to visit with you further about that, though.
Okay. Representative Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I thought I'd never get the attention.
I was late because I was in a car accident.
Oh, no.
But I'm fine. I found out later that the person that rear-ended me was a Kerry supporter, and the police officer insisted that she was trying to push me off the road. But I'm doing all right. Sorry I'm late, but sorry for that digression. But,
doesn't pay to have those stickers in the back.
Commissioner Johnson, I'm hoping that there's real accurate data with where we are right now, so that if we do this project and apply this money, we can really measure if more money helps. That would be one of my main concerns, and I would be very interested in looking later than did more money make a difference in helping some of these things. And secondly, is there any data as far as, is their family structure much different there as far as number of people that are married or divorced, or you know what I'm saying by family structure? Is it much different than the rest of society, and is that having an impact?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know that we have the answer on the family structure. We probably could be able to find that from looking at our data, so we will look at that and get back to you if we can find some reliable information.
And before I get to Representative Westerberg, I'd like to officially call this meeting to order. I'd better do that sooner or later. Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner, as far as reading this right, as far as it appears to me that this is a new program that's going to be starting up in 07, but my understanding would be that the Indian community has received help for welfare situations for children in the community in the past. This is just a new division or a new program. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westerberg, this is new in the sense that it is providing essentially taking some responsibilities, funding responsibilities that are now with the county, and putting some money here that would allow then that capacity to develop within the tribe to deliver those same kinds of services and pay for those same kinds of services.
Okay, so my point is that is there somewhere in the budget where we can see how the Indian community has benefited specifically from the program or participated in the programs in the past, or is that just included in the general numbers and now we're allocating specific dollars for that treatment or help?
Is that...
Mr. Chairman, Representative, currently there's about $1.5 million that's allocated to tribes and urban programs to provide earlier intervention services and sometimes to work with counties to support reunification. As Assistant Commissioner Johnson indicated, this is really moving a lot of the jurisdiction for the core child welfare services to tribes to determine if we can achieve better outcomes if tribes have more control over both decision-making as well as services for children on the reservation.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gravel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm kind of piggybacking on Representative Gazalka's comments earlier. I can't imagine anyone would find opposition with this program, but it seems like we're kind of in a reactive mode where we're trying to solve a problem that exists there. From a study standpoint, is there any data out there that shows us what's getting broken in the past, what's happening, what are the root causes of these issues that we can kind of fix there so that we're not working in a proactive manner as opposed to reactive? Do you have any suggestions or analysis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, and clearly part of the root cause is just the severe poverty that exists on the reservations, and there's a high correlation between poverty and kids who are coming into the child welfare system. There may be other issues in terms of high levels of chemical dependency among some American Indian populations. Again, there's a correlation there with child welfare. I'm not saying that this proposal is going to solve all those underlying problems. I mean, there are a lot of underlying problems there that are driving this, that are very difficult, long-term problems that can't be solved by a small change in the way that we approach dealing with it. We're just looking here at one way that we think may help with some of these kids to try to straighten out the lines of authority, to try to provide more support to the tribes in doing that, because part of this is also not just the money that would be available to the tribe, but also the relationship we would want to build as a department in working with the tribes and helping them build capacity to provide these services and try to get better outcomes. And I think the our bottom line is we want to be looking at better outcomes in safety and permanency, and this is the project we're putting together to see if we can accomplish that. If we don't, then we need to look at another way to do it. If it does work, then we need to consider if we need to expand it or take it in a way that's going to have a broader effect for other tribes and other kids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Johnson. I've been looking at this budget since it came out, and I'm not finding a lot of new money coming in. So my question is, this is $4.8 million. Where are these funds coming from? Are this new money coming from the casinos that we're planning on, or is this money coming out of local government aid or another child welfare program? Where'd you cobble the $4.8 together from?
Mr. Jess?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, the budget here represents the priorities of the Department of Human Services within the target that we were given in terms of working, which was obviously a target that was overall a decrease in funding. So across the department, we are proposing a budget that is less than the current law amount of funding that will be provided, although, as Deputy Commissioner Boudreau pointed out, still a substantial 15% increase by any medium, even with the governor's recommendations. So this this is priority setting that we made within the department of trying to focus on looking at a few small areas where we thought we needed to make investments for the long term, because in the particular case here, we have a population that we don't think we're doing very well with, and we think that, the dollars, some money, may be a way to try to turn that around and to come out with better outcomes for these kids. We don't believe that simply because the state is in a deficit position that it's appropriate to ignore problems where we think we can make a difference. But obviously, you know, with the situation we're in, those are relatively small and relatively targeted.
Representative Mahoney.
Right. So this is the new money coming out of that 15% increase that you were talking about. It didn't take money away from another program or shift it from one of the child welfare programs and carve it out and put it into this particular little program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I mean, within the overall department's budget, you know, all the money is fungible at some point. I mean, we had to meet our target, and we looked at the kinds of places we thought we needed to make investments. We looked at the options that we had for making reductions. We balanced that out to get to the target we needed to get to. This was something that we thought was important enough to do, despite the fact that overall we had to make a reduction in our budget. So it didn't come from any one place in particular. I can't point to a place where it came from, and it wasn't something that was done just within my area of the budget. It was something that was done across the whole department, looking at what our priorities were overall.
And then, Mr. Chair, one last question. I have had some pretty extensive ties in the Native American community, and actually, they never really talked to me about this. So I'm just wondering, were they involved in the designing of this particular program? What kind of input did they have? Who was the, is there a contact person you work with from the community, Native American community?
Mr. Chairman, President Mahoney, as I mentioned before, we've been working a lot over the last couple of years, particularly with the northern tribes, where we have a lot of issues that cross between the sort of state-county system and the tribal system, and particularly in the child welfare area, although, as I mentioned, we have a number of other areas we're working with them as well. This just grew out of that discussion with the tribes and with the counties in those areas about what the issues were and the fact that we continue to run into sometimes very particular situations, an individual case that's coming to our attention through the county or through the tribe where there's been a conflict around that case and where it seems like consistently over time this difficulty of trying to get these two lines of authority to work in the same direction doesn't seem to work very well in a lot of cases, and we think that this might be one of the issues that's driving the poor outcomes for these kids, and so it's an area we decided to focus on. I don't think the particular aspect of this way of doing it was something that we took to people and said, should we try to do it this way? In fact, I think that's part of what we're trying to do now as we're talking with the counties and with the tribes, but we've put this out here. Are there additional ways we need to be shaping this or looking at it differently in order to make it so it's going to work and address what you think the issues are?
Thank you. We'll continue with your overview, please.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Can I just make a comment, please? Thank you. I just want to be clear, this actual part of our budget, though, the part of the department's budget that's in this division, has an 11% decrease, if I'm right. We don't benefit from any increase. We have the decrease in this committee, if I'm not mistaken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I think if we look overall at direct appropriations, that there's about a 1% increase under the governor's budget for the accounts that are in this committee.
Mr. Chair, maybe we could ask Mr. Soderberg to check on that, because my information is different. It would just be helpful to be on the same.
So what you're interested in is, are the checks written by the state bigger this year than last year? Is that what you want to find out?
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering how this division, charged with the very important work we have to do, is being treated in this department's budget. So we got a whole new part in here, and I'm trying to understand it. Mr. Chair, could I just make one other kind of a comment?
Certainly.
Which is, I think there's been some very thoughtful questions asked about Indian culture and Indian family structure and so on. And it strikes me that maybe I think I could be helpful here. I have the privilege of representing very many American Indian families, and I think there's other committee members who do too.
You know, it's not an accident that the disproportionate placement of children out of homes are two of our cultures that have been, one, enslaved and brought here, the African-American, high rate of children brought out that are out of home placement there, the damage that did to family structure, a whole population whose land, I'm talking about American Indian folks, were taken away from them forcibly in violent, you know, war. And so I think the impact lasts for generations from what I've been able to tell. The other thing that I'm very familiar with is families who are broken up. I have friends a little bit older than my age who have told me painful stories about being taken from their home, put into Indian boarding schools, denied contact with their parents, beat for speaking their language. Indian religion was illegal until, I think, sometime in the 60s, you know, when it's formally changed. What that does to family structure is really deep. And we know about post-traumatic stress syndrome that happens in a lot of other kinds of situations. And I just think maybe what I could try to offer this committee, if people would like, would be some opportunity to maybe sit down with, maybe an informal setting. I could offer it at Minneapolis American Indian Center or maybe St. Paul. We could bring together some sort of opportunity for people to really hear about where some of these difficulties come from. Because I think one of the directions we can go with this is really reinforcing the strengths that are in that culture and not just being aware of the problems. And there are things that we do that either help to, you know, help make those cultural links stronger or harm them. So if people would be interested in that, I'm just suggesting maybe we could have that kind of opportunity for this committee, Mr. Chairman. You and I could talk about it later, but
I look forward.
I'd like to offer that.
Mr. Johnson, you can continue.
Mr. Chair, I look for advice on how to proceed. I have seven additional change pages to go through. And
I totally agree, and it's very apparent that we are not going to get through in this session. We're going to have to, we've already gone to call Labor and Industry to ask them to come back Thursday, come to our committee Thursday, so we can have one more day of overview from your department, and we'll look forward to that. So I hope you can sense the newness of what you, the Human Services part of our committee is, and the thirst for knowledge that we have. And it's very apparent to me, and I'm finding this all very enlightening, and we have to sift through it, and I appreciate your indulgence, and I appreciate the time that you're going to spend with us.
Mr. Chair, we will plan on spending more time.
I look forward to it.
Mr. Chair, the next budget page related to this area is page 14, change page. This is an adjustment to the appropriation for adoption assistance and relative custody assistance. Adoption assistance and relative custody assistance are programs that pay assistance to people who are adopting kids who are guardians of the state who have had their parental rights terminated. It's assistance that's provided. Often these kids have some kind of severe disabilities or emotional kinds of issues, and the assistance is provided largely to help offset the cost of taking those kids in that are then born by the adoptive family. It's a very important function in what we do of trying to get these kids into permanent homes where they can be well cared for after they've gone through a very traumatic event of being removed from their home. What this page does the assistance for these programs is an appropriated account, but actually the way the statute reads, it is available to everybody who's eligible for it. So we actually project each year how many people we think are going to need the assistance and then try to adjust the appropriations to match. That's what this page does. We've adjusted our projections downward for 06 and 07 and then put in new projections for 08, 09, which weren't there before because we didn't have a budget didn't go out that far, based on what we now believe to be the demand for adoption assistance and relative custody assistance. The downers that you see in 06, 07 are not any reduction in service. It's just an adjustment based on a new projection of how many people we think are going to need those services.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Johnson, could you elaborate just a little more on the 2008-2009 numbers, particularly 2009 looks like a fairly significant jump.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, what you see there is that we've been doing this kind of adjustment for the last several years, so we make a forecast and then we try to adjust the appropriation. So coming into 06-07, there was a base that had been established for 06-07 based on the projection that we had made in 2003. There was nothing that had been made for 08 and 09 at that point because they weren't in the budget horizon. Because it's a fixed appropriation, the 07 base was just taken and straight lined out for 08-09. But our forecast of need shows that actually there's going to continue to be an increase over the course of those latter 2 years with a line that sort of goes up at a steady slope. And because of that, we're requesting additional resources above what was the fixed 07 base. And it's a pretty steady, I think, if we look at in our projections, we're projecting about $30.7 million for 06, $33.7 million for 07, $36.7 million for 08, and about $39.7 million for 09. So that's the kind of steady increase that we're seeing in the use of these dollars.
Okay. Very well.
Mr. Chair, members, the next page that relates to this area of our work is page 15. This page is entitled Prevent Homelessness for Young Adults Transitioning from Long-Term Foster Care. And Ms. Sullivan Sutton was making her remarks. She mentioned that we have about 1,200 kids over the age of 16 who are either wards of the state or are in long-term foster care as a permanent disposition. At age 18, these kids essentially transition out of the system. These are kids who are a very high-risk group. Again, many of them have disabilities, about 57%. All of them experience the trauma of being removed from their home, moving through foster care, being guardians of the state, and so forth. There isn't a very good system right now for helping these kids make a transition into adulthood. The counties do have responsibility for developing plans for these kids as they're making that transition, but they don't really have a lot of resources to support that transition as it's being made. The particular concern that arises frequently with these kids as they're making the transition is housing and homelessness. From a separate look in the survey that Wilder does every few years of the homeless population, they found there's about 500 to 600 homeless youth on a given night in Minnesota. 70% of those have been outside their home for some reason, either because they were removed through the child protection system or through corrections at some point. So clearly the kids who get removed from their homes are very much at risk of being homeless. We see this as a prevention kind of initiative to help head off some of the homelessness for these folks, very connected to the governor. Priority of trying to end long-term homelessness in Minnesota. The proposal actually requests $1.1 million. Again, this is a place based on the need that we see where we think we need to make an additional investment for these kids. These kids are an obligation of the state. They are often state wards where we have a legal obligation as their parent. We think it's important that we live up to that obligation. The $1.1 million would be used to help develop public-private partnerships to sort of build some supports around what the counties are currently doing to work with these families. So it's not to replace what the counties are doing, but to build off of that planning process. Money would be largely done through nonprofit vendors. We would do RFPs out for that. And we're requesting a staff position to help coordinate not just the grant process, but also the building of the public-private partnership, which we're already at work on trying to work with philanthropic resources and businesses in identifying ways that they can help bring some resources for these kids as well. Mentorships, internships, things that can help the kids get a foothold into the world of work so that they can be in a better position to live independently when they turn 18. Mr. Chair, I'm going to move on now to the next area in our department, or in my administration, I'm sorry, and ask Jim Huber to come up.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Jim Huber, and I'm director of the Community Partnerships Division, which is a part of the Children and Family Services Administration. Community Partnerships covers a vast array of different kinds of social services and works with counties and tribes, voluntary agencies, community action agencies, and other academic organizations within the state of Minnesota. My primary reason for addressing the committee this morning is to talk about the Children and Community Services Act, which is administered in the Community Partnerships Division. The Children and Community Services Act is a consolidated fund of 15 separate state and federal grants totaling $126 million each year for 06 and 07 for social services for children and their families and certain adults and people with disabilities. This is the base funding, which includes both state and federal dollars. The Community Service, the Children and Community Services Act provides for local decision making within broad parameters and reduces mandates and administrative red tape, if you will, for counties. The Children and Community Services Act is built on the premise that planning and decision making for social services is best provided at the local level. Counties submit a two-year plan, spending plan, to the department for the department's review and approval. The county plan requires describing specific services and their expected outcomes. This planning process assists counties in prioritizing services according to what they see as their greatest service needs within the dollars that are available to provide them. Some counties may have a greater aging population and need to direct more services towards that demographic, while in other counties the need is greater to focus spending and services on children and their families. The formula to distribute the community social services dollars to counties consists of three factors. One is, and they're the historic factors. If you check the legislation, you'll see that it's to follow the historic formula, which is basically the county's population, their poverty percentage of poverty, and the percentage of the county's population is above the age of 65.
Represents law.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt. We're just trying to track, and there seems to be many, many, many pages with things like children and community services grants. Can you just clarify what pages we're talking about? So we can kind of try to follow along a little bit.
92. Oh, man, I opened right up to it accidentally. Page 92.
Thank you.
Now that you found the page...
In the white pages.
I've basically finished my presentation.
Thanks.
Glad I could help.
Mr. Chair, are there any questions on this?
Seeing none.
I'd like to then ask Janelle Bush to come up and present the adult services programs that we have.
What pages are her programs on?
Well, that's a good question. Mr. Chair, I believe that you find in your white pages the programs that Ms. Bush will be talking about on pages 94 through 101.
94, 100, and 1?
94 through 101.
Very well.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Janelle Bush. I'm Director of Community Living Support in the Department of Human Services. My responsibility today is to talk about three primary programs in community living support, and the title tells you something about what these programs are supposed to achieve. First of all, community living supports are programs that provide income assistance and support to people who do not have enough income, who may have disabilities, who want to live in the community. These programs are administered by the counties, and they're directly responsible for determining eligibility and the kind of plan that these people need. The first program that I'd like to discuss is general assistance. This is a program which provides monthly assistance to individuals who are either in a crisis or have a permanent disability. Many are waiting to be determined permanently disabled under the federal SSI program, Supplemental Security Program. Our expectation is that we will be serving approximately 12,000 people a month under this program in the current fiscal year. The maximum individual benefit for this program is $203. The second program I'd like to discuss is something called Minnesota Supplemental Assistance. This, too, is an income supplement program that is provided to individuals who are currently receiving Supplemental Security Income, which is a federal program. It is an additional small sum of money, $81 a month approximately, that is provided to individuals to live in the community. This program is something that is required, it's a required state supplement to the federal program of Supplemental Security Income. The number of people served by this program currently is approximately 28,000 people per month, and this includes families and individuals. The asset limits that we talk about when we talk about these kinds of programs are something to point out. One of the things that we find is that when individuals are in need of support from public programs, we require them to spend down to fairly limited asset levels. And the level at the in the MSA program, or Minnesota Supplemental Assistance Program, is something like $2,000 for an individual for assets and $3,000 for family. So we require that they be spent down to those levels before they can become eligible for some of these programs.
Is this the money that we're talking about, a senior citizen in a nursing home, and this is the money they have for their discretionary personal needs spending? Is that what money we're talking about here?
It can be. One of the things that happens in nursing homes is that most of the individual's income goes towards the care, but every individual is entitled to a personal needs allowance. Sometimes that comes from their own income resources, maybe retirement benefits or something like that, and sometimes it's paid by the state through one of these programs. And it varies depending on their circumstances. Mr. Chair?
Ms. Lau. Mr. Chair, I was going to say, is this the money that the ARC folks have been having meetings about?
I'm sorry.
We're invited to meetings about SSI cuts and things. Is that this money? We're trying to figure out which money, obviously. It's not clear to us which money.
Right. We have, Mr. Chairman, Representative Slaywick, there are a number of different programs here that we're trying to talk about rather quickly, and so if I've confused you, I'm apologizing about that. One of the things that we're trying to do is say that we have several programs that serve different populations who are typically people who are experiencing either a crisis or they are disabled. The first program I was mentioning was General Assistance, which is a program that's a basic income assistance for individuals who live in the community, who are unemployed and not able to work. The second program, which is called MSA, Minnesota Supplemental Assistance, is an add-on program to the federal Social Security SSI program. What it does is provides a small additional amount of money to the base amount that an individual receives from the federal program. These people are also age, blind, or disabled, and are determined to be so by the federal government. Those are the two different programs. To complicate things further, we have an additional program that I'd like to discuss today, and that's called Group Residential Housing. All of these programs are funded by state funds. Group residential housing could be seen as another community support, but it's for individuals who are at risk of institutional care, such as nursing homes, who want to live in the community, aren't able to do that if they have the proper service supports. The group residential housing program pays for the room and board in licensed or registered settings in the community. Typically, these are settings such as adult foster care, board and lodging, and some assisted living facilities. And again, this program provides for basic room and board support for individuals living in those licensed or registered settings. It's a way of helping people live in the community in a less costly and more livable environment than in an institution. And it's been a major factor in helping individuals leave nursing homes and other residential facilities in the state. The number of people that we serve in that program is approximately 15,000 people per year. Now, all of these programs together represent, again, the state's effort to have people either stay in the community or live in the community as independently as possible. There's been a great push over a number of years to have people leave institutional settings, in part because they may not be appropriate, but also, more importantly, at least on the budget side, because they are very expensive settings that may not be necessary. One of the things that we also focus on in terms of the income supports is that individuals are seen as in transition if they are receiving some of these supports. We find that in the general assistance program area, they're required to apply for federal SSI assistance, which is the one area where you are determined to be disabled or not. That requirement means that that funding is not considered permanent for those individuals. It's seen as a help or a bridge to get them into the SSI program if they're eligible. This is a quick and dirty summary of the three income assistance programs that the state of Minnesota has at the Department of Human Services. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I just wonder if we could have a report at some point, maybe not right now, but on the number of successful applications from these folks who are trying to, we ask them to apply for the federal Social Security Administration dollars. And I know that's not easy. It's very, very standard, and they sometimes have to go through several appeals, and then they're deemed fine. And I think it's a delay tactic in some cases because they're really obviously people who are disabled. I'm just wondering if you could help us quantify what those, how that's working, how we're doing with that, what kinds of numbers of people get turned down, how often, you know, is the legal assistance available to them to help them pursue that? I know some people just give up, and some of the folks we find without any services. So I'm just, that's one question. And then, is there any cut to any of these programs? I just realized after the last gentleman testified that we missed, and I don't know if it was just an oversight, but we missed talking about the fact that that particular program is in the yellow pages, mm-hmm. and there's a $25 million cut to it. So I'd kind of like to know more about that, why we didn't talk about that. But also, in any of these programs that you talked about since you're here, is there a cut to any of these programs in the governor's proposal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, there are no cuts at this time. One of the things you notice is that these are forecast programs, which means that we forecast the number of people who could be considered eligible in the state of Minnesota. That forecast is subject to change, but it is basically an increased number over the past biennium. And so there will be an increased cost in each of these programs in the next biennium.
So, Mr. Chair, can we get data on what the shortfall might be? Can you help us understand what that might be? The shortfall between the increased numbers of individuals and the, if I understood you correctly, there's going to be an increased number of individuals and but a constant number of dollars. Am I wrong?
Mr. Chairman,
they go up
Senator Clark, no, the forecast means that it would be tied to the number of individuals who are considered eligible. So the department has a system where we keep those in track together.
Mr. Chair, the forecast amount and the increase are built into the governor's budget.
Right.
For these programs, and there are no reductions proposed. In answer to your other question, Janelle and Jim actually work in the same area, and so I was going to take up two budget pages, including the reduction in the CCSA at this point, or whenever Janelle was done with her presentation. Sorry for the confusion on that.
Any other questions? You must have covered it very well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I have two budget pages that are related to the areas that Jim and I are working on. The first one is on page 17 of the change pages. This is to address homelessness with supportive housing service grants. This proposal requests $5 million a year for flexible service funding to support supportive housing. This is part of the governor's plan, the state's plan, to end long-term homelessness by the year 2010. As most of you know, in 2003, the governor requested and legislature approved a process to develop a business plan for ending long-term homeless. Long-term homeless are those people who lack a permanent place to live for a year or more, or continuously, or at least four times in a three-year period. So we're talking about people who really are homeless over a fairly long period of time or are repeatedly homeless. Most of the long-term homeless are experiencing some forms of disabilities. 48% have a chronic health condition, 52% are mentally ill, 33% are chemically dependent. So it's a very needy population, and often just getting housing isn't the solution. They need housing and they also need services, and they need those two things to be tied together. And that's why in the business plan that was developed by Commissioners Goodnow, Marks, and Fabian, the focus is on trying to develop supportive housing for these people, 4,000 units of supportive housing to help a place for these long-term homeless, both to have a stable place to live but also to have the services combined with that. Most of the people that I'm describing are eligible for other services that are provided through the Department of Human Services, mostly, and probably other places as well. Getting those people connected to and keeping them connected to those services is an important part of making supportive housing work. What we've also found, though, where supportive housing is now running is that usually the supportive housing needs some additional flexible service funds in order to sort of hold together those services in a way that will keep the person housed continuously. Sometimes folks aren't eligible for some of the services that we provide. They might not meet a threshold for mental illness for services under Department of Human Services program, but may in fact need some kind of help with their mental health. These dollars will help sort of hold those pieces together. There has been a pilot operating for the last several years testing supportive housing, just starting to get some, well, we've got some data out of that. We want to have final data for another year or so. But it shows real promise for keeping these folks, not just keeping these folks permanently housed, but also for pulling together the services they need to help them become more healthy. These are the grants that would be made to counties or consortia of counties. We're really looking at working regionally on this and not just with individual counties. We would look for them to try to pull together all the mainstream services that folks are eligible for, so we're maximizing those services and using these dollars to sort of fill the gap for the people that are in the supportive housing. This is a proposal that is connected to the bonding request for developing supportive housing, the physical side, the capital side of it, in the governor's bonding proposal. And we expect that these dollars would be used to work with MHFA developments, either through those bonding dollars or some of the development they've been able to make with some of the dollars they already have for developing on the capital side supportive housing opportunities.
Thank you. Any questions? With that, I think we don't have enough time to probably go into our next one, and we would appreciate if you'll be back on Tuesday for our meeting, and we will continue this overview on Tuesday. I had a feeling when Deputy Commissioner Claudeau came and says, well, how do you want to proceed? Do you want to get done right away? And I says, I don't think we'll ever have a chance of doing that. This is a very inquisitive committee, and we want to make sure everybody has all their questions answered. And I appreciate you coming back, and I hope we can get it done next time, but if we can't, we'll have you again. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, when we come back, could we please have a detail on that $25 million cut to the CSSA? I'd really like to know about that.
Sure, that would be the budget page I'll start with next time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. While we're at it, I'm sure Representative Ruth read the minutes of February 9th very thoroughly, and she moves the minutes. All in favor of that motion, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. That was adjourned. Thank you very much.